Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wild, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Werkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have a very exciting episode, even more so, I would say, than usual, because we are once again having our crossover episode with the drama podcast, our sister pod at this point, with how many episodes we've done with them. But it's with two of our best friends, Connor and Dylan McDowell, again, from the drama podcast. We've had them on previously to talk about Chicago, the film, and the Broadway production, A Star is Born. That was our latest episode, and we talked about all four films, which was very fun. And then we also did West Side Story, the original and the remake from 2021. So go back and listen to those if you haven't already, or if after this episode you decide, oh my God, I can't wait to hear more from them. But welcome back, Connor and Dylan.
Drama. It's good to see us, isn't it?
Oh, you're fun. Well, we are wearing pink and green. And this is Connor speaking.
We love a visual component to an audio-only format, as we often joke. But yeah, I am wearing pink. This is Dylan, just for the uninitiated listeners. And I do identify as more of an Elphaba.
And I, Connor, do identify as more of a Glinda. But, you know, we had to make do with the costumes that we were given today. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for having us back. This is absolutely one of my favorite traditions at this point.
And we've been talking about doing this movie, this episode, for so long.
We really have. It's been such a long time coming. And I agree. This is my favorite episode that we do every year. I think it's just always around the holidays, too. So it feels nice and warm and cozy. And I can't wait to talk about this movie with you guys, because at least last year, we really went back in time, talked about some older films with the versions of A Star is Born, except for 2018, of course. And with West Side Story, we had the original in addition to Spielberg's. But this is a brand new film that audiences everywhere and most critics are really loving. And it has a place in the Oscar race, I think, already. So this will be a very fun conversation.
I'm so excited. Oh my God. That gave me chills hearing you say that it's an Oscar contender. Because as Broadway lovers, like for us, like Wicked just, I mean, it's one of those mainstays at this point. It's been around for 21 years. And so to hear now that like audiences are maybe discovering it for the first time is such a thrill. I mean, Connor and I have loved Wicked since we were in sixth grade. And so, and we were made fun of. I mean, like it was one of those situations where like, you know, like closeted young gays loving Wicked, people would like literally say goofy things to us in the hallways about it. And now I'm seeing those same people share stills from the movie to their Instagram stories and whatnot. And it is, I feel so validated 2 decades later.
Well, I was going to ask you, once we got to the musical, might as well just do it now. What was your introduction to Wicked? I'm assuming it was the musical, which came out in 2003. Like, were you old enough to go to the theater and recognize or understand what you were seeing? I'm not trying to age you guys, but like, what was that experience? And obviously, you both are in love with Broadway. So how has that relationship changed throughout the years with this show? I think previously, Connor, you said Wicked was your favorite show or maybe most seen from Broadway. So I'm curious, like, how that has changed over the years and really culminated with this movie, this part one.
Funnily enough, we discovered Wicked at the movie theater.
Yeah.
We were at the Cinemark in Valley View. Summer 2006?
I want to say six.
Yeah. And you know how, like, now they do, like, a Maria Menounos pre-preview is...
Newbie.
Yeah, exactly. But back then, they had, like, trivia that would play on screen, at least in this specific period of time. And I remember them playing a song from Wicked. And we were...
It was Defying Gravity.
Defying Gravity. And we were obviously, like, little theater kids just, like, bursting at the seams. So we loved it. And, you know, Idina Menzel, Kristen Chenoweth. And so we... From there, that was our starting off point. And then we got the cast album, became obsessed with it. In seventh grade at Independence Middle School, shout out, they took the entire class. I mean, there's only like 100 of us to Chicago. It's like a school trip. We like stopped at Notre Dame on the way, went to Chicago.
That's the Midwest classic. The Chicago trip. You guys do that too?
We did.
We sure did in high school.
That's so funny. I mean, like, obviously, eighth grade DC trip was also another pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. No musical component, but we got to see Wicked as part of it. And so the entire class saw it. And so Connor and I, of course, were the experts. Like, we were like, you know, we had one teacher who literally spoiled the entire plot, like, part two details. We weren't of the age to understand like what would be happening. So she's like, and then this character becomes this girl, you know, things like that. Spoiler alert. But we were the foremost Wicked experts. I remember reading like the Grimmery, which was like a piece of merch you could buy on the bus back, and everyone wanted to borrow it. And it was just, you know,
we were obsessed.
It was a thrilling time. We didn't see it though until that Chicago trip. It was in Cleveland that same summer that we discovered it, ironically. And then it came back for many, many years. We finally saw it on Broadway. Was it summer 2008 or 9?
2009, and it had Aaron Tveit in it as Fiero, which
we were
like, oh my God, obsessed.
Big moment for us.
And it's been in our lives ever since. I mean, we would see it every time it came to Cleveland.
I work on the Broadway show now,
which is crazy. So it is part of my life every single day. And then to see the film finally happen has been a surreal experience, just beyond. It is still one of my favorite musicals. It really is.
And Nick, you asked like how our relationship with the show has changed. I know that I can personally say like it's always just kind of there as like something that I know that I love. I know that it, you know, when it comes to Cleveland, when we're home for the holidays, I know we saw it with our parents and Hunter 1 year. And like, it always seems to come into my life in moments where I need it, whether it be something that reflects the relationships and the friendships in the movie, or like randomly, you know, in like 2016, 17, the storyline about animals in cages became a huge deal, like post 2016 election, and like the political implications of this movie coming out now. Like there's so many, it's like one of those things of like, why do stories constantly get retold? And it's because they're constantly relevant to different audiences and things that are happening. And so I love it even more and more as years go on. I'm not as obsessed as I used to be. And Connor and I used to be able to name the order of every actress who replaced, you know, Idina Menzel, Shoshana Bean, Eden Espinosa, and, you know, going on of all the other stuff, but it's not there anymore, but we still love it. Absolutely. And with our podcast Drama, we get to talk to so many of the famous or infamous alumna of the show. So.
Oh my God. I love that. Well, I spoke to Helena York via Awards Watch. So that like kind of brought those memories back of seeing her in videos. And I was like, holy crap, what? So it's like, yeah, I have questions about actresses from multiple productions later on. But it's funny you set a line. I'm curious if this episode will have as many Easter eggs as the movie did, because he said it comes into our life for a reason, something we have learned, da da da. And I was like, Dylan, you're just thinking in Wicked speak.
It was unintentional, but you know.
It just found its way into your brain at this point. Just it's there to stay.
Well, I had that question for you guys. And then Sophia, you said previously that you were reading the book, which is what the musical was based on. We have lots of adaptations here based on Gregory Maguire's 2005 novel, Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. So did you finish reading the book? What did you think of it? I hear it's very dark. So like, was anything added to the movie that wasn't in the stage adaptation?
Yeah, so it's funny because I'll answer the question about my relationship with Wicked first, because it is connected to the book. So I remember my mom reading Wicked, the book, at the pool when I was little. And I wanted to read it because I thought the cover was so cool. And I liked The Wizard of Oz. And I remember it had Elphaba's hat in this circular design in the center of it. And I just wanted to read it. And I remember telling her I wanted to read it. And she said that she didn't like it. She didn't like the book at all. I just remember her not liking it. I didn't read it for a really long time because I remember that. And then I was just like, oh, okay, like maybe I'll read it later on. And then I just never ended up getting to it, because then I think the musical really took over. And my first experience with Wicked was Glee.
Oh,
so, yeah. So there's an episode in season one where they performed Defying Gravity. And then, of course, Idina Menzel was in Glee and Kristen Chenoweth is in Glee. And I think people thought, of course, of Lea Michele as this heir apparent to Idina Menzel in many ways. I mean, obviously, she also plays her daughter in the show. But that was where I first really discovered it. And then I ended up seeing a touring version of it in Columbus when I was in high school, and then saw it later on Broadway once I had moved to New York. But it was never one of those shows that I became really obsessed with, I would say, but I famously like plays more than musicals. So that's what my yearly theater run always is. But I do think Wicked has this staying power, I think especially for people in our generation, in our age. Like, I just remember people that I went to high school with who were musical theater being obsessed with Wicked. Like, that was the show of our time. It was like Rent, Spring Awakening, Wicked.
Yep.
Yeah.
Those were the three that I feel like everyone was just really into. And so the book, yes, I did read it. I finally have read the book, and I didn't really love the book either, I think, but it was also because I had the show in the back of my mind, and there are some big differences. It's very dark, and I understand, I think, how its themes translate to the show specifically, but why certain things from the book couldn't really be executed in practice. There's so much darkness around the Elphaba character in particular early on that just wouldn't really translate to a stage show. And I think, though, some of that was preserved. I think in the movie, there weren't too many things that I caught that were differences from the musical that were pulled directly from the book. And it's been a while since I've seen it on stage, so you guys can correct me if my details are off. But I think that the parental relationship we see in the movie is somewhat close to what we see in the book. I think those things were incorporated into the movie in a way that they aren't as explicitly in the show.
For sure. No, you're right on. Yeah, I forgot to mention, when we first got into the musical when we were like 12, we both read the book.
Which is, oh my God.
Psychotic. Whoa. I mean, what we processed, who can really say?
What I remember it is how sexual it was. And I definitely did not understand all of that. So I wonder if I should go back and reread it, but also very political.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yes.
Connor, you mentioned how sexual the book is. One of the things that they obviously couldn't put into the movie, but I want to mention that would have been crazy if they included. Do you remember the philosophy club?
Yeah, I remember this. The there's like a tiger orgy sequence, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes. Yeah. It's all orgies and sex shows revolving around the animals.
I must have blocked it out.
Well, you were 12. But yeah, I had to mention the Philosophy Club, which I think feels like the Ozdust ballroom like the interpretation of that a little bit here, but obviously far more tame.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That is so funny. P.S. Need to reread the book. Literally my takeaway has been I need to find my careworn copy that's around this house somewhere.
It's much more focused on those supporting characters who I think are introduced here in the movie too, like the Bowen Yang character, for example, that's from the book. So I think they flesh those things out a bit more, which is interesting. And I think we can talk about, you know, with dividing this up, this movie up into two parts, once we get into that, I think they did try to really beef up the story and introduce characters in a way for this that will come back in when they make part two. So if you feel like when you're watching part one, like, who is this? What's happening to this character? I think based on the book and just knowing that a part two is coming, that we're going to see more from those characters, even more than in the stage show.
Yes.
When we get this part two of the film.
Yeah, I think it's very much like a Dune situation of the movie adaptations that we've had, because I feel like we're at a place and we can talk about scenes and the ending in particular, but we ended a place where people who have seen the musical know what's coming, but other people don't. And I think to have those endings, I mean, there's a lot of story to be told left, but those endings for them is so important in the existence of Oz. Back to Dune, Wicked, it's not the only book. There are four books in the series, and it's very rare of me to like read a series. And I think the way that all of you and really the views that I had seen from the book previously don't make me want to read it, period. But I don't think we'll be getting like a Dune Messiah, the second book, like Wicked, the second book, which is called Son of a Witch.
Yes.
After this.
That tells you everything you need to know, by the way.
Yeah.
Is the title of that. Yeah.
There are endings to characters in the book that I think would just turn the movie on its head. So I don't think that's happening. I think it's interesting how they brought aspects to the stage in the film to make it more cheery and so beloved. I mean, mm-hmm. the stage adaptation at this point, like you said, Dylan, 21 years later, has grossed $6 billion. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And it's not the longest running show, but it truly could be in time. So it's kind of exciting to see that. I think let's get into the movie. We'll do our normal description and all of that. We can just dive in. So description here, Elphaba, an ostracized but defiant girl born with green skin, and Glinda, a privileged aristocrat born popular, become extremely unlikely friends in the magical land of Oz. As the two girls struggle with their opposing personalities, their friendship is tested as both begin to fulfill their destinies as Glinda the Good and the Wicked Witch of the West. The movie was directed by John M. Chu and stars Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande Butera, Jonathan Bailey, Michelle Yeoh, Jeff Goldblum, Ethan Slater, and more. You mentioned Bowen Yang already. I think the big thing that people who knew the show and were excited for the film is that the movie is called Wicked. And then you go into the movie and you see that title card and it says Wicked Part 1. I laughed out loud because I'm like, there it is. I hadn't seen it yet from the millions of screenshots now on Twitter of everyone taking those before the movie. But what did you guys think of this as a part one being 2 hours and 40 minutes? Is there too much? Is it bloated? Or do you think it's worthy of that runtime and that title?
I have to say, when it was announced that it would be two parts, I rolled my eyes so hard. I was like, oh my God, this cash grab. They're just trying to really, you know, extend this for as long as humanly possible. Because I haven't loved, like, for example, with Hunger Games, or actually, I didn't mind it with Harry Potter 7, but with Hunger Games specifically, or I think Twilight Breaking Dawn split into two, I just didn't love that. However, I was very pleased with this being a part one. I felt like in the musical, although act one of the musical is around 90 minutes long, which is a long act when you're sitting there, you know, while this story just going by and by and by, like, oh my God, I have to pee. But it didn't feel too drawn out for me. I know some people are saying like, oh, the last 20, 30 minutes could have been like slimmed down a little bit, but I really felt it gave moments that felt kind of rushed in the stage show a lot more time to breathe. What do you think, Dylan?
Completely agree. I mean, I'm going to come right out and say at the beginning of this that I find it to be a close to perfect movie. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was such a treat. I mean, I think, Sophia, you might have said it earlier, it's like almost universally beloved so far. Like, or maybe that was you, Nick. But I especially see the theater people that are in our lives just gagging over this movie. Like, it is just beyond everyone's wildest dreams. It's the maybe the film folks that I'm seeing, like film critics from, you know, different publications that I think are being a little bit more critical. I think it's because we've had a slew of just bad movie musical adaptations.
Or even worse, very mid movie musical adaptations where you're kind of like, meh, I forgot it even happened.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, like they direct Netflix. Yeah, like The Prom or the Dear Evan Hansen movie. Like, some of them were serviceable, but others just didn't hit the mark. And with something, there was so much writing on Wicked that I just think they really, really nailed it. And not to say the press tour, them releasing what I felt to be almost the entire movie in trailers, I was surprised that they didn't. You know, they were releasing trailers, it seemed like, every week in the lead up. But I found that everything that was added was so intentional. All the relationships were really deepened. And the animal plot lines were able to be sort of bulked up. So I found it to be profoundly successful, but at the same time loyal to the first act of the musical. I have high hopes that the part two, which I guess I'll just say this now, of the musical, and I was talking to Connor about this last night, it's a play-by-play act two of Wicked is. It's this is happening. This happened. Them arriving to the scene when things have just occurred or a lot happens off stage. And that's when, like, Wizard of Oz is pretty much playing out, is act two of Wicked, simultaneously. But I think they have a really great opportunity to maybe be less loyal to the musical with part two and expand the Elphaba Fiero romance, for example. Glinda assuming this political figure role that she has that we meet when we meet her at the beginning of part one. So without straying too much from your question, Nick, I thought it was a slam dunk home run sports reference.
Well, as the non-theater person, I think, of the group, I'm not going to tease a loosely a Michelle reference here, Rain on Your Parade, too much. I actually do understand now, aside from the cynical cash grab reasons, why they felt the need to split it into two parts. I didn't really feel like it was too bloated. I think there are some decisions with certain songs and stretching them out that I do want to ask you both as theater people, if they worked for you with the decisions that John M. Chu made. I actually, Nick, I'm so happy that you brought up Dune, because I have a whole section in my notes here written out about Dune. I actually view this as Dune in reverse. So it makes sense this is in conversation with it, because I think Villeneuve, you know, what I didn't like about Dune was that I thought he was too concerned with the world building and the look and the aesthetics that he completely neglected the characters, and I didn't end up feeling anything for any of them. And this movie, I actually have the opposite problem, where I thought that you had these great characters and you have a strong story and you have these incredible performances and the music, and it's so easy to get swept up in that. But it looks really rough at times, specifically, I think, because of the cinematography and the lighting. And I feel like if you have this, what should be a Technicolor dream, to have so many scenes feel backlit or washed out or really dark, where you can't really see the characters in the way that you want to, it also makes it worse when you have the 1939 The Wizard of Oz in your mind, which is just this glorious, colorful dreamscape. And I know John M. Chu has said that he wanted it to look more like reality, but I think that this isn't a movie about reality, like the themes are, but this is obviously in a fictional place, and I think you should lean into those fantastical themes a bit. And the real world has a lot of color in it, too. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that excuse and that reasoning, but
yeah.
Overall, I think I did like it more than I expected to. I was a little worried when I had seen those stills, but I think I understand the split now, at least, in why they broke it up in the way that they did, and I thought it was successful in that way.
Yay! Yeah, I would agree. The lighting, I think, is certainly an issue, and a lot of people are also complaining about the sound. I don't know how the audio was for you with the sound mixing at Studio 35, but it was good for me. I saw it in like XD, and I thought it was fine, but a lot of people are complaining that it was quiet.
It was good for me, actually, in my theater. I think that the problem, really, with the sound was just that everyone was so into it. People were cheering, and we didn't have too many people singing along. But this film has applause breaks. At least it feels like it does, because after every song, people decided to stand up and clap, or we would get little cheers here and there. And again, it's probably important to note that I saw this for the first time at a public screening in Ohio on a Monday night. So this is not opening night or anything like that. And I overheard multiple people in the crowd say that they had seen it 2-3 times. They were going back again and again to watch it.
Wow, that's wild. See, yeah. I saw it. They held a private screening they called it Friends and Family. And it was like the original Broadway cast was invited, the current Broadway cast, quote unquote, notable alumni witches were invited, certain press, everyone who works at the theaters, like box office, ushers. Like, it was really, really special. Marketing, advertising. So it was really cool. And Mark Platt and David Stone, the producers, were there. Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande, John M. Chu, Bone Yang popped in. And Kristen Chenoweth, of course, was there. Idina Menzel sent a video message beforehand.
Respectful.
It was respectful and fully filmed like a cameo. Like, she was kept like glancing off screen for the script.
She probably did it with the cameo she also had to get done.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it was one of the most overwhelming cinematic experiences of my entire life. Just having loved Wicked for so long and then to be in the same room as like all the people I just mentioned, plus especially Kristen Chenoweth. Like, she's everything to me. And Ariana Grande. And so I was seated like house left, and it was a really small in the DGA theater is where we were.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was like Kristen Chenoweth Center Orchestra or whatever. You know what I mean? And then Ariana, Cynthia, and John were watching from the back, but Ariana kept coming from the back to the middle to sit next to Kristen. And then she'd bounce back to stand with John and Cynthia. And then she'd run back over. And it was such an intimate vibe that it was hard not to be paying attention to like how Kristen was reacting, how Ariana was reacting, and everyone was cheering and clapping. And because the Broadway cast was there, I mean, everyone was so supportive, but they would cheer for like Elphaba's mom when she flips her hair. Like they're all like going wild for little moments like that, that I feel like, you know, moviegoer might not. And the applause was crazy. And also I was crying almost the whole time, just out of being overwhelmed and emotional. Mm-hmm. I definitely need to go back and I'll not see it again this week. Revisit some of the moments that I definitely missed. Because even like watching people react online to, you know, their reaction to the film, I'm like, how did I miss that? Or like, what on earth? I don't even remember that happening because I was so caught up in it. Also, I had to pee probably 20 minutes in. So that was also really tough.
That's brutal. That's always tricky. Yeah.
Anyway. Nick, what was your take on the movie? Your first viewing, maybe only for part?
Well, it's funny you say having to go to the bathroom because I saw a video and a woman was like, you can go during Dancing Through Life because there's little plot, but it's all spectacle. So it's like, if you want to miss the least
of
story and still get it, then go then. But I'm like, no. And then I thought about it and I'm like, well, fine. I just never go to the bathroom during a movie. Even if my bladder is about to explode, I'm like, you know, even during Matt Reeves, the Batman, I'm good.
Wow.
So I understand that part. I guess before we get to the scene, I loved the movie. I think growing up, I had seen it 3 times on stage in Cleveland at Playhouse Square, the West End, and then on Broadway, most recently, like a year or two ago. And I love the soundtrack. It is one I return to over and over and over again. Like the first time I ever did karaoke, I sang For Good with my friend. Like,
aww.
It's just something I've returned to. So leading up to the movie, I was really excited. I was listening to this on the car to Six Flags. It's just, I love so many songs. And probably like most people, it's act one heavy. And then I get a little bored during act two until like their relationship comes to the center again. At first, I was not a fan of the wizard. It was like anytime he came on stage, fast forward, there's your pee break is like a sentimental man.
No, for real. That's why I think Dancing Through Life might be the worst time to take a bathroom break. That's one of the best songs. Yeah, in the movie.
Yeah. And it's just like that set design is crazy. My jaw was on the floor when they were spinning. And then John M. Chu. So I guess I was at a screening with him as well. I think, Connor, that's just like the best way to see a movie because you are so elated and just the atmosphere. And that, I think, helps you or maybe makes you like it a little bit more as well.
Yeah, you're winding down a little bit.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, if you can, why not? And I was also at a screening at the DGA later, but it was with Cynthia, Ariana, Jonathan, John, Steven Schwartz, and Mark Platt. So it was just like seeing everybody was surreal. And then hearing them talk about it and hearing just the story of how it came about from like the mid-90s and they were going to make a movie. And then Steven was like, no, please, can we do a musical? So it was cool to just hear the evolution of this idea and story and bringing it to the stage. And I think the movie, to me, again, all of that to say, I've been very excited for it over the years. And I wasn't going to let like people being upset with the color grading or lighting destroy my excitement for it. And so I just totally loved it. I didn't cry a ton. I cried a little bit. But I think the spectacle of it all, of them building Oz from scratch, most of it really helped in terms of it feeling real, like you were there, like you were hopping along with Elphaba during The Wizard and I, and then, you know, in the room. So I think all of that made me feel like it was somewhere where you could go and study. It was this fleshed out world where I felt the power even more than on stage. I think the time is totally valid. Getting to understand the characters a little bit more, you know, like the character of Madame Morrible, or like you were saying with Dr. Dillamon, like those darker themes, you're able to feel a bit more and relate them to present day and like what we're going through politically. And it was really scary. Like, I got goosebumps in those moments. I mean, even just in the beginning, during No One Mourns the Wicked, Glinda's like the evil one.
Yeah, she's the wicked, right? Mm-hmm. If we think about it.
Crazy. So it's like, to start the movie there, I think was also very cool, even before the title. And yeah, I loved it. I loved all of it.
Yeah, no, I think there have been some, you know, everyone's an expert on color grading now when any movie comes out. There are stills from it and people have comments and complaints. But on the political themes that we can definitely dig into, and I think this will come up when we talk about the Oscar race as well and how timely this movie is. A thing I kept seeing when I was watching this was kids looking at their parents during certain moments with the animals, like when the lion comes in the cage, or when they're taking the animal's right to speak or ability to speak away from them, kids looking at their parents, almost like having a moment of recognition that they could relate what was going on in the movie to what was happening in real life. So I do think that this is going to be a really interesting and possibly powerful tool for people of that age to, you know, have something that they can watch that explains or expresses what's going on in the real world that's different from other films that are out that are very much for adults that also eerily relate to the moment that we're in now. I think the timing for the themes in the movie couldn't be more perfect, really.
Oh my gosh, a fraudulent leader who gaslights an entire nation of people. I think that you place what you want onto certain aspects of art, but I completely agree, Sophia. And I think that that could propel it in the Oscar race. I mean, there's a Harris Walls America where maybe Wicked isn't necessarily hitting as hard as it might have that it is now in this post 2024 election. So
yeah, and everything just with Glinda too, and her willingness to just conform and to say, you know, don't push it. Let's just side with them. Let's just, you know, make things right and copacetic. That is, I think, unfortunately, right, when you actually see the wickedness in that and how misguided decisions like that are. I wanted to ask you all really how you felt about the casting. I feel like we can start talking about the characters too, because first, Dylan, you alluded to this in your rattling off of former cast members. Do you have any favorite cast members throughout the stage production? And I guess, how did you feel when you found out that Cynthia Erivo was playing Elphaba and that Ariana Grande was our Glinda?
I was utterly relieved when both of them were announced. Cynthia has become such a breakout star. I mean, we didn't know who she was. I mean, 2015 is like, I think, the first time I remember hearing about her, when she was in Color Purple in the West End. I think she's obviously phenomenal. She, to me, was the requisite Elphaba now. Like, she just unveiled certain layers of the character that we've never seen on stage, probably at least in the Broadway production, because there's never been a principal Black actress who has played Elphaba on Broadway. There has been in international productions, specifically in London currently. But I was thrilled about Cynthia. And Ariana, I knew she would absolutely pop the corn and feed the children. I mean, she comes from a Broadway background. She was in 13 the Musical when she was a kid. And then, you know, she grew up on Nickelodeon. Those kids, they have it. There's just something in that training. We're seeing it now with Selena Gomez and Emilia Perez, of course.
Wow.
But,
wow.
You know,
the other big musical.
Yeah. But as far as favorite Elphabas and Glindas over the years, some that are not crossovers, of course, I'm just going to say names that probably won't, you know, mean anything to some people unless you're really in the Broadway world. But I'm quite partial to Julia Murney, who was a Broadway Elphaba, a British Elphaba named Carrie Ellis, who did it then on Broadway. I love her so much. Shoshana Bean is another one of my favorites. Yeah. Glinda's Megan Hilty, who folks would know her now. She's starring in Death Becomes Her on Broadway.
She was in Smash on NBC.
Smash.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She, I think, sort of changed the game with Glinda. The Kristen Chenoweth interpretation was very different. And as it went along, they really leaned into the comedy and some more of the physicality with Glinda as different actresses stepped in. My girl, Annalee Ashford, was a Broadway and Chicago Glinda.
And then I have to give a shout out to my baby daddy, Aaron Tveit, who was Fiera on Broadway as well. No, he's great. He's great. I'll just throw out a few more names just because I have to. Kitty Rose Clark is Glinda. Kendra Kassebaum is Glinda. Edna Espinosa is Elphaba. I mean, the list goes on. And I have to mention some Fieras. Nick Adams, Constantine Rasulli, Sam Gravett, and Taye Diggs did it. So there's been great Fieras. Not to say, though, Kristen and Adina, they are the blueprint. And so, like, to me, yeah, they will always be legendary in my eyes.
If I could go back in time, I would 100% 2003, want to see the original Broadway cast, because that is history. And I agree with most of what Dylan said. I have to say, I was totally on board when Cynthia was announced as Elphaba. Like Meryl, like Sister Aloysius in the film Doubt. About Ariana's casting, I had doubts. And I just was not impressed with her in the Hairspray Live production that she was in and in other like acting moments. I knew she was an incredible impressionist from years of viral videos and interviews and stuff like that. And obviously love her music, love of love. But I was really skeptical, if y'all, I have to say. She completely blew me away. She was my standout performance from the film. I think it was a perfect performance. And I'm still wondering if it was like a performer meeting the role or a performer breaking on to like a new acting side of their career. I'm still not sure, but I am sure that she was perfect as Glinda in this movie. So loved those two as the two main witches.
For sure. Those high notes are just insane. And when she went there, like even again in that opening number and No One Mourns the Wicked, you're just like, what? Like you expect some level of difficulty or excellence in a movie like this and a role like that. But it's like, oh my God, it went above and beyond what I was expecting. So that to me like solidified it. And I think the relationship that we saw between them throughout the movie really was enhanced by their casting being so perfect. I really love Cynthia Erivo as Elphaba. I think, you know, she has been Oscar nominated before and I didn't see her on stage. That's like the biggest moment of FOMO and regret that I have in terms of like not seeing The Color Purple. But I think she just really brought out this side to Elphaba, this very personal human aspect that she was right to defend in some of that lead up to the movie's release via social media and whatnot, that I think just, you know, kind of overpowered things with certain people. But I really loved her. In terms of other cast members, like it was funny just looking through the list, like Justin Guarini as Fiero. I saw him in Britney Spears musical.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
From Justin to Kelly. Crazy.
Honestly, Kelly would be a good one to put in there for some role. In the future, I feel like she would maybe do a Madame Morrible really good. But
whoa.
Also, we had
that's
oh
Jade.
God, they love it.
Beauty as hell.
She's gonna be too old to be like Elphaba or Glinda. I don't know.
Sure,
but wasn't meant to be shady.
Maybe back in the day, though. Yeah. Sure. As in the
right, exactly. Yeah. Like they should have paired them and like capitalized on American Idol back in the day.
That would have been something.
Maybe that's the answer.
Wow.
Yeah.
For one of our questions.
Oh, yeah.
But like Cheryl Lee Ralph talking about her as Madame Morrible in press interviews, Alexandra Billings, also Miriam Margolyes.
Iconic.
Just like I would have loved to have seen her. And I think the most iconic one that we have to mention because of Cabaret we've talked about on the show is Joel Grey was the original wizard on Broadway.
Yes.
Which also feels incredible.
Cleveland native.
Cleveland.
Yeah, Cleveland.
Yes.
He wasn't supposed to be the wizard. It was a different actor. I forget it right now, but he backed out last minute and they asked Joel Grey to do it. And I mean, to me, we talk about movie cameos. I would have, there's still chance, you know.
Right.
I would have loved to see Joel Grey in some capacity in part one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A living legend.
I love Joel Grey. One of my favorite supporting actor wins ever. I really loved Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande here. I think I was also skeptical about Ariana's casting because I had trouble visualizing her as a blonde, as that type of blonde, I think, as Glinda. But knowing that she had wanted that role forever, that is its own kind of power for a theater kid, I think. like, if there's a role like that that you've wanted forever, you're going to make sure that it works. And she did.
She did. I think Marie, Lea Michele getting Sunny Girl eventually.
The parallels are there, I think.
I did, and I agree, Ariana is, she, you know, maybe more of a honey blonde or something that they went with, ultimately. A lot of people are also about her eyebrows, but, you know.
Yeah, I think, like, the makeup, you know, you want a little bit more contrast in your makeup, but I think that the performance is just one of our great comedic performances of the year. One of, when we think about musical theater performances, too, and Connor, you were talking about, like, an actor meeting the role or what that does sometimes when you see an actor in that role that is the perfect fit for them. I think that was this for her. And she, I think, you know, in a role where, like you said, it's really evolved and become more comedic in the years post Krista Chenoweth establishing that tone for it. I thought her moment, her comedic moments were spot on. Her physical comedy was great. The way that she would like flip her hair. And we'll talk about Popular, but that is one of my favorite renditions of it that I've seen based on the staging of it and how she performs it. I feel like she puts her own twist on it, too. And Cynthia Erivo, I wish I could hear it all in one go and not how it was broken up in the movie, but potentially my favorite version of Defying Gravity vocally.
We need the radio edit.
Yeah.
So we can hear-
I want the radio edit.
Why didn't it play during the credit? You know how they'll do that. You know, they'll create
like the it's just, so, I think her performance, what's interesting about it and what I really liked about it is that she seems so wounded. Like she just carries everything with her. And I feel like that's so important for this character. And it's a different twist on it when you're thinking about a Black woman in the role in particular. And her, I think, and she's talked about this in the press tour too, but I think it's more meaningful, the role suddenly. It takes on really a new facet when you think about it relating to identity, specifically racial identity.
I love that you're holding space for that right now.
Yeah, it's about time someone said it, holding space.
And can you believe it took us this long?
It took us so long.
All joking aside though, I completely agree. It's literally a show about a person of color. And so it is, and Cynthia is so empathetic in the way that she delivers anything. I mean, she is masterful in the movie. And I love that it's sort of, you know, you're hit with Ariana right away, but with Cynthia, I think it sort of unveils itself as it goes along, her performance. So I'm really excited for part two to see what she does with it. Because that's really where the Alphabet character is, like, front and center, musical. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I think with her, you know, another big thing of the release of the movie is that, oh, like we sang for real on set, and that's a big thing and also a thing that people hate to hear. But to see those videos of Cynthia flying through the air doing flips during Defying Gravity, you have not seen this before.
Yeah.
And to hear it, it's just insane. So I think she took it there. Her doing her own stunts, it's just magical to watch. And again, I think something else, while not everything is practical, there are some blue screens and green screens. Like, she is doing the work, and we have to applaud her for that, because the sound that we are getting from that through a corset, through flips, and still the range that she has is phenomenal. She really is defying gravity, and it's beautiful. And then, I mean, you talk about Ariana Grande and then how Glinda has transformed throughout the years in that character. Ariana really holds all of that. She does the physicality. She trips over the chairs. She flips her hair with ease. You know, she has it all. And I think that's why a lot of people are applauding her, or maybe saying she's the breakout of the movie instead of Cynthia, is just that her character is so comedic throughout the entire movie and she holds it. But I think with Elphaba, she builds. So they're just different characters. And yeah, I am excited to see where they go in part two, because it changes a lot.
Where are you guys on the live singing for movie musicals? Because it's a talking point that comes up frequently of, oh, we made the decision to sing live for this. I'm curious what you guys think about that. Like, would you rather them record or do you like that choice here?
I'm so mixed on it. You know, there's a moment in High School Musical 1 when
Sharpay Evans is very Glinda. Yes.
Well, I remember, I think it's in 1 when Zac Efron sings live the start of Something New to Gabriella in her bedroom towards the end of the film. And that's some of the only times he uses his own vocals in that movie. But in moments like that, you're like, wow, this really works when there's not like the music playing behind it. Like, that's a moment I know it's a silly reference, but that really works for me. In something as big budget as this, I honestly I don't know if I'd been able to tell if they were singing live or not. In fact, I don't even know if we knew it was live when I saw the movie. It didn't stream as live to me. I know that might sound stupid. And people who are like sound experts can be like, how can you not tell? I really couldn't tell.
Yeah.
What did you think, Dylan?
When I think like, oh, they sang live in the movie, I think Les Mis. Like that to me is
okay. Yeah. Moaning on the by the sun.
Stars a skip of a song every time.
Normally, I mean, it's so powerful. But
okay.
Yeah.
I think it's fine with this because the way that they pulled it off, it was almost like a magic trick in ways. They're all so great. There were some performers, maybe like Jonathan Daley and Michelle Yeoh. I'm not really certain how much was live or what was happening there, but they were all, I mean, they were, you know.
Ooh, Michelle. Oh, look at that note.
Oh, Michelle was kind of doing the, I think she was miscast here. I feel that was an unfortunate reality of this being a musical, and I understand why she was cast and her relationship with John M. Chu. I love her in Crazy Rich Asians. And she sort of gets away with it a little bit, but that character does the Emilia Perez speak singing frequently. So I think that's how she decided to approach it. But if you're going live, it's trickier if you're not a classically trained singer or someone who that comes naturally to.
Apparently, the soundtrack to the film has completely different versions than what you hear in the movie. I've yet to listen to the soundtrack of the movie.
Hmm.
I wanted to see it again in theaters before listening to it. One of the few musical moments that they cut from the movie version is a little, they call it a tag. It's a reprise of The Wizard and I that Madame Morrible sings to Elphaba when Elphaba gets the invitation from the wizard to go to the Emerald City. She sings like a little.
Dylan, would you do it for us?
You know, I'm not warm, but she says, now you're off to meet the wizard. It's just like a really quick line.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think you need to do it.
They couldn't.
They're not doing it.
Dylan, you're doing
it. No.
Do it. Sing live.
It's one of the moments in the music, one of Morrible's only singing parts in the musical. Mm-hmm. And it obviously, you know, reminds the audience that Elphaba's always wanted to meet the wizard by singing Wizard and I again. But I was waiting for it in the movie and it didn't happen. And I'm so bummed. Yeah. What do you guys think? Could you tell if it was live or am I crazy?
I don't know if I can judge that. It's hard for me to really know. I don't think I would have noticed if I didn't know beforehand, especially because, I mean, Ariana and Cynthia both just sound amazing. Yeah. And I'm sure it would have sounded even better if it wasn't live. But I also think there's a power in singing it live that they probably brought some sort of emotion to it that they might not have been able to get in the same way in the booth. So yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a preference one way or another. I feel like it worked regardless. I will say that.
I agree with that. I fell into it so quickly that I wasn't also trying to find out or see if I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do that sometimes with movies, like with cuts or edits and seeing how that changes a movie. But with the voices, again, it was like everyone sounded good in the beginning. I kind of just let it happen. I think the other voice maybe, or really just character in general, that doesn't have that much range is the wizard. I don't think Jeff Goldblum had to do a lot of singing anyway. Maybe I'm not the one to comment on that because I don't like the wizard character, period. And not just because he's evil. It's just like those songs don't do anything for me.
Yeah. That's your bathroom break, I think, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the wizard gets a full jazzy number in part 2. It's a song called Wonderful. And so it'll be interesting to see how.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Yeah.
Now, let me plead for the little
figures that he used.
The miniatures of Oz.
I found that to be a cute way for them to musicalize that number.
It was.
Skip sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I will say I also liked the one backdrop that we get with him. That reminded me, I thought that was, I know for all the complaints that I do have about some of the visuals, I thought that was really beautiful and it gave it that magical quality that we do see in some of those 50s and 60s movie musicals that I think I found kind of missing from some of the other parts that looked a bit more Harry Potter-like to me.
Yes, I thought about Harry Potter a lot during that.
Yes, a lot. The sixth movie in particular, Half-Blood Prince. I kept thinking of the design for that when I was watching this.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
The backdrop moment is when he goes behind the curtain. It's the man behind the curtain moment.
Yes. Right?
Okay, which I loved that as an Easter egg for Wizard of Oz as well.
And that maybe is like why I liked it too.
Yeah, like the balloon jumping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Also with the, I wanted to mention Harry Potter in the beginning with the like the series that I don't read. That's one of the only ones I have read. And yeah,
proper
like when
millennial.
They were in the classroom sequences, it just felt like we were in some like mid-series Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson. And I'm like, something just doesn't feel quite right now. But I think that's the connection is like, this feels like Harry Potter, you, Sophia, talking early on about like what our generation connects to, millennials, I think in particular, maybe not for long with the series coming, you know, remakes, but that is something we connect to is Harry Potter. Like we grew up with that. That was our phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this could be the next one for the next generation.
I was wondering that actually of how many people will watch this and think, Ariana is my Glinda and not Kristen Chenoweth, right? Like, they don't have the reference in the same way that we did growing up. So will this Wicked be like one of the defining movie musicals for that age group and these characters in the same way? And I think even more so than West Side Story, I know we had that discussion when we talked about the 60s version versus the 2020s version of which one would be the defining one. And we were thinking, you know, it was up in the air, right? Because the original won Best Picture and is a masterpiece in its own right. And Spielberg did a fantastic job with the remake. But this movie is making money in a way that West Side Story did not. People want to see Wicked. So it's becoming, I think, it has the potential to become this phenomenon this Christmas and Thanksgiving that other movie musicals haven't in a while. So. Yeah. That's its staying power, potentially.
It's so crazy. And it's interesting to me because I think Wicked made choices that Spielberg didn't for West Side Story, like NBC Universal backing Wicked and doing this long advertising push with this long press tour, casting one of the biggest pop stars in the entire world, but such huge global reach that people they want to see her in this. And they know Wizard of Oz. And also West Side Story, why am I like defending it when like, I don't need to, but it came out during like the Omicron surge and—
Right.
We're still kind of in COVID. There wasn't a huge star in it. The Golden Globes didn't even happen that year. Like we didn't get a televised version.
Yeah.
I remember famously advocating for Rachel Zegler. Yes, we did.
And then you went back and retracted that opinion when we later recorded.
And I am here today. You know, anyway, the wind blows, y'all. And I have changed my tune once again. And I am fully on board with Rachel Zegler now. So
did you see Romeo and Juliet?
I saw it twice.
Ooh.
She's quite good.
Did you see Spellbound?
I think I'll be skipping that.
Did you see the Snow White trailer before Wicked?
It did not play at my theater.
It didn't play at my theater.
It played at mine.
My favorite thing about that. Wait, that's the one with Gal Gadot, right?
Yeah.
I love the tweet that goes around or wherever it's going through now, probably Instagram and Blue Sky. But it's a still of Gal Gadot. If the version of the caption is just something like you can tell even if it's the screenshot, she's acting so poorly here. West Side Story versus Wicked. Yeah, I know. I still just wish that West Side Story had more of a cultural impact than it. I mean, obviously Ariana DeBose, another Ariana, won an Oscar for it, but I loved that movie. I think Ansa Elgort was we need someone different. We needed a different
tone. I think so too. We had a great riff.
You did. Nice.
Yeah. And I think maybe we'll use this time to talk about how you felt about the direction. But I think the big plus side to West Side Story for me was seeing someone like Spielberg, not someone like Spielberg, Spielberg behind the camera, a master of blocking and composing a shot. And he clearly was referencing those classic golden age musicals in his direction. And it's phenomenal work. It really is. You watch the clips, you return to the movie. There's another clip floating around on Twitter that I saw today. And you realize that, at least I realize, I'll say this is my opinion, John M. Chu is not an auteur. Like, he does not, I don't think, have a clear point of view that distinguishes him from other filmmakers working, where you watch a film and you know it's his. And there were certain songs and ways that he would film the choreography that I just wanted him to focus on the dancers a little bit more. I wanted to see their full bodies. I didn't need so many quick cuts and all of these shifts and changes and split screens. And I get why he incorporated some of those things, but sometimes I just, when I'm watching a movie musical, I want the scene to be able to breathe. I want to be able to see the dancing. And I do think it was an improvement from In the Heights on the directorial front, but I still, he left me wanting more with how certain scenes were composed.
Yeah. Nick, what did you think?
Well, I've already seen prognosticators putting in John M. Chu in like the director top five. And I don't think that's a thing that I come away from the movie loving. I don't know if I would agree about In the Heights, because I also like that movie more and have to rewatch it to see what I think about the directing in particular.
Me too. I wasn't paying attention to the directing in it. I was just like, I was just, you know.
I mean, I think it was the fact that we had a really good movie musical, and we, like you alluded to earlier, don't get many of them. And I just loved it so much. I was like, oh my God, here we go. We're back. But I don't necessarily know about that. Yes, I loved Crazy Rich Asians, but that's not a musical. I think putting in John already for director is a little crazy.
Mm-hmm. A little.
And we weren't doing that for Greta Gerwig in Barbie. That
there
feels a little sexist. So I don't necessarily think the direction was the part of it. I think the acting, like we've already talked about, like they went there, they brought everything they could. The set design, the costume design, all of that made it feel real. You know, maybe some of the choreography was weird, but like I'm also obsessed with them topping the books and that dancing part of it. So like there are things that feel stupid.
It reminded me of the Eras Tour.
Oh no.
It was very like swift arm movement involving an academia related object.
Are you talking about Dancing Through Life in particular?
No, I mean, what is this feeling?
What is What is this feeling? Yeah.
Okay. It was definitely TikTok ready. I feel that a lot of the choreography, that's what we're in right now. I did find the choreography to be successful and whimsical, especially Dancing Through Life, which, spoiler, all of Fierro's movements are very, you know, like a scarecrow and very loose. And he even like struck some scarecrow silhouettes. Like when at one point his arms are like up on the revolved bookshelves, that I was, ooh, this is good. But you know, in a musical that's mostly ballads or like, you know, people singing to each other, like I thought that those two major dance sequences were good. I would have liked a little bit more unified choreography in One Short Day. I think I was also very distracted by the additions to One Short Day that I wasn't able to fully, I was like crying, you know. It was one of those moments, the cameos really caught me off guard. Yeah, I thought the choreography was mostly successful. I can't speak to the direction. I just don't have an eye for that like the two of you do. But I understand what you're saying. Like, one of my biggest issues with Ryan Murphy's The Prom was that he cut away from most songs to show flashbacks, which is a Ryan Murphy classic, flashback.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But it was just like, come on, like, let the music speak for itself. Let the scene speak for itself. So, I don't know. I'm excited to see this again. And I'll watch What Is This Feeling, the opening with the split screen a little closer this time, for sure.
See, that is one thing that I do love is the split screen, because that, I think, cues you into them feeling similar things, but from different perspectives. And then I think coming together by the end when they're singing Defying Gravity together and they have the same sentiment, but from different sides of the aisle. And so I think to see that transformation of character especially with Glinda from the very beginning, which becomes this whole flashback. I mean, did we need, like, let me tell you the whole story? No, but
I kind of liked, you know, that. I don't know why. Like the storybook thing.
Yeah. And seeing like little snippets of what we would see eventually. But I think it cues you into the characters more, which I did like. Yeah. So again, some of it is maybe a little cheeky, but in the end and overall, like, I am willing to write things off for the sake of the greater good.
We are speaking in wicked speak.
I know. Literal. One last dance moment I have to mention with is the Ozzfest ballroom scene when Elphaba arrives and she and Glinda share that their first real friendship moment where, I mean, everyone's talking about it online, in real life, everywhere. It's an impactful moment in the musical, but it's fairly rushed, you know, as it has to be. And that scene gagged me. The choreo, you know, whatever. I don't know. Whatever. But the emotions were beyond. I cried. I cried.
Yep.
Oh, beautiful. Aww. Yeah, that was the heart of the movie to me.
It changed us all for good. That's the last one.
It was a bunch of little interpretive
in the hand
dance
thing.
Like movements.
It was just so unique.
Yeah, totally. Something I loved is that Ariana said in an interview that she didn't fully rehearse that and memorize it. So that when she was following Elphaba along in that scene, it looked like something like, oh, I'm trying to keep up and connect with you in this moment. I thought that was lovely.
Mm-hmm.
So did you guys have a favorite number? And did it differ from your favorite number when you listen to the soundtrack or see it on stage?
Oh, my God. My favorite song in part one is The Wizard and I. And it was breathtaking to me in the film. It was, I think, a successful direction, too, because we didn't see a bunch of other flashbacks to, like, Elphaba as a kid or things. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't take the Ryan Murphy route. We saw Elphaba kind of exploring in the world building that as much as we got, including the desert at the end.
Giggling, and I think it's because of the Jeff Goldblum monument.
It is.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was something. Almost as jarring as the statue in Gladiator 2 that's meant to be Marcus Aurelius.
But it looks like Paul.
I literally laughed at that. But
no, Maximus.
Maximus.
No. It was
meant to
be
her dad.
Yeah, it was meant to be him. And to me, like, her interpretation of the song was so beautiful. She didn't stray too much away from the written notes. And there was a few little wristed runs here and there, but she communicated that song so beautifully. And I cannot wait to re-listen to it after I see the movie again, of course. That was great. I know. I'm between two. This is so random. I loved No One Mourns the Wicked, you know, the opening song. I thought it just really set the tone. Ariana's voice was unbelievable. And like you said, when she hits those top notes, you're just like going for it. And a note on her more dramatic acting, there's the moment when Glinda tosses the fire onto the witch.
The effigy.
Like, And the look on her face as she's walking away from it, like, you know, on a rewatch, you know, they were friends. Like, she is probably filled with such regret and devastation about this whole show she's having to put on right now. And I just thought that was the moment when I was like, oh, she's taking it. But Dancing Through Life was insane. I loved it. It was very long. Very long.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to insert a moment here about how much you love Jonathan Bailey? I mean, I feel like I can't believe Connor has named over a man. Yeah,
I can't believe it hasn't happened yet.
I almost did it so many times already. Like, someone mentioned costumes. I wanted to be like, well, I wish his pants were a little lighter and tighter.
They were pretty tight.
They were pretty
but
tight.
But they could have been tighter. Just like Paul Mescal's hem could have been a little bit shorter.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'm
Gladiator 2.
Jonathan Bailey as Fiero was incredible. And I know he's like a normal height of a human, but because Cynthia and Ariana are so short, he looked so huge next to them, which love.
Connor would say probably an XL.
He brought it for his head out. He was so charming. I mean, did he look way too old to be attending, you know, school?
Of course.
Well, Fiero's failed out of every other school, so maybe he's just still yet to receive his GED or whatever it is.
He's continuing ed. It is, like I said to you guys, it's the University of Phoenix.
Exactly.
We are all adult learners at Shiz University.
But I thought he was so great. Like, I mean, he's obviously like this bisexual icon of this school. Like the boys love him, the girls love him. Everyone loves him. I'm sure the teachers, I'm sure Miss Cottle is gagging for him.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Kay Alicetto, drama guest.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod.
And I was also curious about how he would sound vocally, just knowing what his voice is like. And I felt like he did some like British pop starisms in there, a little bit George Michael vibes. And obviously he's a beautiful dancer. And that whole sequence was just great. I loved it. And it kind of took my breath away. Nick, like when you mentioned the Ozdust Ballroom set reveal, oh my God, it was so inventive. I just loved it. I just loved it. What about
Ron? Incredible. I think with Jonathan Bailey too, I mean, you guys talked about him on your pod about being this gay Hollywood star. And I think that's really important too. But him flirting with so many students was hilarious, but also had me like really hot. Like when he is standing on the counter in the library or the desk and he's sliding on the books, and then like at one point I think a kid in a chair like slides back and then he pulls him forward, I was like, "Ooh, I need a second." That was so good.
And Nick, he was in the room with you too, so I can't even imagine the experience.
Oh,
beyond.
I know, it's just like, oh, over here. So hot.
I was thinking that's like a less erotic version of the chair pull in Challengers. When Patrick pulls the stool in with his foot.
That's true. That's true.
You know, when I was watching Jonathan Bailey in Dancing Through Life, I love him in this. He's so charming. I love that song. I kept thinking, what a catastrophe it would be if Harry Styles played him.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was thinking about that kind of British pop star, flirts with everybody. I was like, this in Harry Styles' hands, this could have gone very wrong.
Yeah.
You've suddenly convinced me, though, that he needs to be in like the 30th anniversary concert version or something.
I think
like
he does. I think maybe like an NBC live.
Because he does the brainless angle. I feel that Harry at times is like, he talks really slow and, you know, totally. Yeah. With the casting of Fiero, to me, Jonathan Bailey maybe would not have been my first choice. I don't even know who would have been. But it just feels like he's so hot right now, like with Bridgerton and Fellow Travelers, that it's just like, oh, well, of course it would be him. And I love that he's openly gay. Like, I can't stress that enough. Like, that's
you need Jurassic Park coming soon.
Oh, of course. You need to have someone, you know, there might have been a world where it would have been Anthony Ramos. But it's to me, the idea that he's attracted to everybody, including Elphaba, who's maybe never explored her romantic feelings or felt someone noticed her in a way. So I think he really was fantastic. Were there any other musical numbers that you all were just dazzled by?
I mean, for me, it's Dancing Through Life. Again, all of the sets with Jonathan Bailey there as Fiero. And then obviously Defying Gravity as this conclusion to part of their relationship, and then getting to see her fly off, I think is really exciting, and bringing it back to her childhood and being this person that she wants to look up to for her younger self. I think that gave me chills. And I think those are the big ones from the show, at least for ones that I really love. In terms of just song power, I think my favorite rendition was like the 15th anniversary Thanksgiving concert they had on NBC.
Oh, yeah.
And Ariana Grande singing The Wizard and I. That was just like hands down the best. So like to see Cynthia meet that at the very least, like that was very exciting for me.
Yeah, for me, it was a song that I do not really care about. That might be a weird thing to say because I know a lot of people like it, but I don't really, like, I've never been a popular fan in the stage show, really. It's just not a favorite. I tend to like the Elphaba songs more. But here, I think what Ariana Grande does in that scene is perfect. I made a comment to my mom after watching it because her costume in that scene is just glorious. It's this like frilly pink cape dress sort of set thing. It's amazing. I'm describing it very poorly, but there's a moment when she's just walking in her room, just over all these trunks that she has. And when I was a little kid, I broke the VHS tape of Oliver and Company because I would rewind it over and over again to watch the scene when Georgette, the poodle, gets ready. And that's where it reminded me of, like, that feeling I had as a little kid. Just like, oh, I want to be this glamorous all the time. It was so fun to watch. I just loved it. Oh. It just made me really happy.
It was amazing. Watching it with having Ariana and Kristen sitting, you know, center mm-hmm. of the room watching it, the whole room stood up, rapturous applause. They were both crying and hugging at my screen. I mean, it was so special, like beyond.
I also loved the ruby slippers that she pulls out at one point during mm-hmm. that season.
Oh, she does?
Yeah, she's like going through all of the items that she has in her suitcases. Oh. Loved that. And the ending, of course, has changed from there's, she does some vocal things at the end there that are, mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, like, is she now like this, she's this generation's Glinda? Yes, but I do think she paid beautiful tribute, especially with the speaking voice to Kristen, because Kristen has mm-hmm. that little Broken Arrow, Oklahoma accent that she can't really shake in whatever she does, which is something we love about her, of course. And I felt that Ariana, as Connor mentioned, she's an impressionist. She definitely was channeling bits of that.
The last thing I want to ask you guys about the songs is I felt like Defying Gravity, despite thinking Cynthia's vocals sounded amazing, I did feel it lost some of its power in the way that he decided to direct the scene and break up the song.
Yeah.
Did you guys like feel that, or was that just a me thing?
No, 100%. 100%. It was really long. I mean, do we know how long that sequence is?
I think it's 9 minutes.
Yeah. It did take some of the wind from my sails for sure.
See, my heart was racing the whole time. Yeah, I was just like,
I still loved it. Like, Sophia, like I still loved
it. I loved how she sounded too. I mean, it kept building and building and building.
They added in a lot of those unlimiteds that they kept.
Mm-hmm.
Hunter hated that, but yeah.
He's like, I could have gone with one last unlimited.
For me, when she goes to fly, and you know, obviously in the musical, it's like the stage magic of Elphaba and the lift, and she's, you know, the it's me part. The fact that she fell and she's sort of plummeting down, I thought that was so epic. And then she sees her younger self. Like, there was just a lot of magic there. I mean, the flying, I mean, Nick, you mentioned she did her own stunts. I mean, it was, to me, I always thought the Wicked movie is going to look so darn cheesy during Defying Gravity, but it did not. It was when she's got the cloak flying. I mean, it was epic. Mm-hmm. Like, even like little boys watching this who might think this is like girly or whatever. I think that is epic to everybody. So it was so cool.
Oh, and I loved, let's bring it back to Ariana, but I loved her acting in that book. Just subtly telling so much story for what Glinda's going through in those moments. And I always do look over at Glinda during Defying Gravity when Elf was flying. Oh my God, wait, I feel like I'm about to start sobbing.
Oh,
but when you watch the stage musical, it's this, like Dylan said, this stage magic of watching Elphaba fly. And you look over at Glinda and she is, you know, in the stage show, she's usually smiling. She's so happy and watching her friend finally burst into the person that she's meant to be and chasing what she most believes in. And I loved that you could see like the close-ups on Ariana's face and that too. It was
movie magic.
I am more Team Dylan. I didn't love the very ending of this, and I think it is the direction. I like the nod to that final moment you have before the curtain falls or it goes to black. And I mean, that really was, I think I had seen the chorus line before this on stage and like that dazzled me. But like when she is flying and she's up on the top of the stage and that cloak just fills the frame, like you have never seen anything like that before. And when you're watching the movie, it's just like she's so far away that you don't feel close enough to her, like from what you're seeing. So it's like, I get it, but you don't feel that power as much. I do agree. And, you know, part of the musical too, it's like that final note is it. And then in the movie, it ends and then she flies off and the music is still going. And it just kind of like fizzles out to me. It's like, oh, like you want to just feel, I don't know, something at the end of it. And you do once the credits hit, like you're still crying, but it's a different impact to me. And I think that's the only thing I trouble with. Like, you know, do we have a low angle camera where like the entire screen is black and not, you know, you can see the weather behind her? Maybe there are renditions where I would change things about it.
I think let's get into some listener questions. We have some fun ones. And then some we'll cover in our Oscar potential section too, because we have quite a few Oscar questions. This question is from Isabel. Recast Wicked with last year's acting nominees. So reminder, we had Cillian Murphy, Bradley Cooper, Colman Domingo, Paul Giamatti, Jeffrey Wright, Emma Stone, Annette Bening, Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hüller, Carrie Mulligan, Davine Joy Randolph, Emily Blunt, Jodie Foster, Danielle Brooks, America Ferrera, Robert Downey Jr., Robert De Niro, Ryan Gosling, Mark Ruffalo, and Sterling K. Brown. That is our roster we can pick from.
Oh my God. Well, one name really stood out for me, and it was Davine Joy Randolph, because she is a singer. She is an amazing singer, and I think she could pull off Elphaba for sure.
She's my Elphaba too. Yeah. I think she'd be great.
If it was a non-musical, Lily Gladstone would be my Elphaba. Love, love, love.
I also have Davine and Elphaba, but it would be interesting if we had her and Danielle, because she can sing too.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like the standout from The Color Purple and the only one nominated there, obviously. But those would be fun if they would switch off. I mean, my boring answer in a way is like Carrie Mulligan, because she is Glinda.
Yeah.
Like, she is such a pretty princess. But, you know, switching things up and having the singers really be there at the forefront is important as well.
I had Emily Blunt as Glinda.
Love.
Because we know she can sing. And she can be blonde. She's been blonde before.
Yeah, in A Quiet Place.
Mm-hmm.
Do we all have Bradley Cooper as Fiero?
No, I had Gosling.
No, I had Gosling. Mm-hmm.
Colman Domingo would be great. Oh, yeah. He's very charming.
I had him at first, too. Yeah.
Paul Giamatti is Elphaba's father. Cillian Murphy, I want to see him do something kind of charismatic, like the wizard. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I know he's young, a little bit young, but
Downey would be the wizard for me.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Wait, what if Cillian Murphy, like, gated up and did the with Balan Yang's character? I think he could be like a sassy queen.
I could see, yeah, like a little bitchy.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally.
Oh, that would be good, actually.
Yeah. Sandra Hüller as Mournable, for sure.
That's Love a good it. One. I also have Jodie Foster as Mournable.
No, she's Dulcie Bear to me. She is full of because she's comforting.
Dulcie Bear, oh my God.
What a fun question.
I'm trying to think who else.
Other characters.
We don't even like talked about Bach like at all.
I have my own listener question about Bach.
We didn't mention Emma Stone, which I think is like hilarious. You know, she literally won an Oscar for a musical movie, but I don't think she's certainly an Elphaba or a Glinda in that.
No.
Yeah, she could probably
be like Bowen's counterpart.
Yeah.
That other
yeah.
guy. Emma Stone will be
Shen, I think.
Yeah, she'd be great in that.
Fanny and Shen. Those are those two.
We also have another recasting question, if we want to just do these together, from Magical Tadrigal. If the Wicked movie had come out 15 years ago, who gets cast as the leads?
Ooh, right. So that would be 2009. I mean, Amanda Seyfried, I think, is Glinda. And that was like long rumored. She wanted it. I think there's even like clips of her singing it online.
She would be great.
Her vibrato irks me a little bit. But I think that she would have been able to pull it off. I mean, yeah. 12-9, how can you not have Zac Efron as Fiero? He was
my Fiero.
He would have been so great, you know. But he was done with musicals at that point. He was like, I'm moving.
We can bring him back.
Passed on the Footloose remake. He was like, I can't do it. But then he did Greatest Showman. So
yeah,
he came back.
Yeah.
Elphaba is a question mark. That's a question mark for me.
That's really hard.
Is it Lea Michele? That's the question.
Yeah.
I mean, she wasn't fully in the zeitgeist yet, was she? I mean, she was in Spring Awakening at that point. I don't. Glee premiered in.
Glee is almost 2009.
Yeah, opposite Amanda. I don't know. I mean, sure. I mean, I think that a lot of people thought it would be Lea Michele at one point. You know, this movie's been long gestating.
I have one.
Yeah. Go for it. Yeah.
Brandy as Elphaba.
I love it.
A grand return. And you know what? Because if we have Amanda as Glinda, you need to have like the singer, like a pop star, you know, like the Ariana Cynthia type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Brandy.
And I love her Cinderella.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that Bernadette Peters would be Madame Mourable.
And why it hasn't happened is anyone, it's the crime of the century. I mean, even on Broadway. Mm-hmm. What about, now hear me out here. And I think she was done with acting at this point too, post Dreamgirls. Oh, Beyonce as Elphaba.
Elphaba. Interesting.
What about Beyonce as Glinda? She can sing the high notes. We all loved her Ave Maria on her I Am Sasha Fierce album.
I don't know if she's funny enough. On her I Am Sasha Fierce album.
Ave Maria.
Ave Maria. Ave Maria. That's right. I don't know.
J-Hud probably could have done it post Dreamgirls.
I was thinking about her too.
I mean, what about for like Madame Mourable? Like, how about the Mamma Mia cast? Meryl Streep, Christine Baranski.
I thought Meryl would have been good in this version. Movie. Yeah.
I mean, she's been in every other movie musical in the last decade. So
yeah. Great.
She'd be so good.
Oh, I think Brittany Snow could have been Glinda.
Ooh.
That's good.
She could do it.
Yes, she would have been good. Because she was Amber in the Hairspray movie, which another great review musical. We should do that on my pods.
I love Hairspray movie.
She's one of all of our faves, Queen Latifah.
Yes, she is a drama wild favorite.
Could she be Madame Morrible?
Yes.
I'm trying to think who was the it girl of that. Of this was when we were in early high school, late middle school.
Arpat and Kay Stu.
I can't think of anything worse.
I'm miserable.
You would never offend Fiero either.
I will also say 15 years ago, I don't think it would have been the most off-base scenario to have seen Kristen and Adina in the movie.
Yeah.
Point.
That's actually really true.
We had Enchanted. Adina was in that. Kristen was in so many movies. I feel their careers both skyrocketed so much. I mean, I would have loved Kristen as Madame Morrible even in this John M. Chu production.
Talking about him, Hugh Jackman, having him as some character, probably still the wizard.
Oh, he could be the wizard,
Who is Dr. Delamond? I mean, we haven't even discussed Dinklage.
We haven't discussed.
Oh, man.
I like the Paul Giamatti casting.
Right, good.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I was a little disappointed they went full CGI with the animals in general. I know there's probably not a world where they wouldn't at this point in movies. It's like you guys were talking about on your Wizard of Oz episode. But I don't know. I didn't feel as connected to that character. And you're supposed to feel really mad when he gets fired and taken away to his doom.
I was most sad when his glasses fell. Oh, my God. I wanted to cry.
Yeah, that was sad.
Yeah.
It was upsetting.
Yeah.
Again, that's way darker in the book than in the movie. It just kind of happens. But in the book, it's intense. Okay, another fun question from our friend Chels.
Hey, Chels.
Who always asks us good questions. Cast the wicked characters into a season of Survivor or The Traitors. So basically, who would do well on Survivor or The Traitors? Glinda's made for Traitors, not Survivor. If she has her glam there, I feel like she would do pretty well.
I first heard this question as who from Traitors would be good and wicked? And I was like, oh, Phaedra, Madame Morrible. But
yes. Phaedra would be a good Madame Morrible.
Oh, good.
On Broadway, we need this to happen.
I know. Parvati as Elphaba. No. I think Fiera would be 100% faithful and not know what's happening at all on The Traitors.
And I think he would only make it halfway on Survivor or two-thirds of the way. He'd be out. He'd be too pretty.
Yeah, pretty people, pretty men, it's kind of rare that they make it very far. Colby made it far, but for the most part, they just kind of shoot themselves in the foot at some point.
Huh. It's so funny.
Elphaba, I think, would do pretty well in both or could do well in both. She's very resilient, but I feel like she wouldn't put up with people for very long, which you have to be able to do.
Yeah,
for sure. I think Morrible would be a target on either one.
Mm-hmm.
She's too smart. Mm-hmm. She's too good. Yeah.
If she won, it would be Denise, when Denise won her season with Malcolm. Survivor deep
She'd
cut.
Be a really good traitor, though.
She would.
Yeah.
The best.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about traitors. I was thinking about faithful.
Yeah.
I think the wizard could be a good traitor, too. I mean, obviously, he is. He's conned all of Oz.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Could win traitors really easily.
Bach. What is Bach? Is Nick, he out early?
Here's my listener question. We're going to do my listener question now. So a while back when this movie was, stills were coming out of this movie, you tweeted a picture of Ethan Slater as Bach and said something to the effect of can I say something?
Can I say something?
Yeah. So I just want to revisit this and ask because people were concerned for you. And I think me included just said no in all caps, but you were when we see him in action, when we see him in the movie, you'll understand. So how do you feel now? Smash or pass?
Most everybody was pass in that circumstance. I will say at the very end, when they're doing all their flashes to everybody watching Elphaba in the sky, that's when he looks the best, but the other stills, with his crazy sweater vests and the big, ginger afro nearly. Like, that's more of a pass. But I think it was cute, actually, in the movie when Bach is into Glinda and knowing, like, Ethan and her together, that it was, like, that connection and him being into her, like, IRL and in the world of Oz. So it was a lot of just,
I mean,
he was
the only straight man on set. Like, I mean, it was
spooked me a little when he was like, I'll do anything for you. Like, yeah, actually, yeah. You would.
Literally. I mean, people would laugh anytime it would flash to him on screen. People would literally laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, he is a friend of the pod. If you did do a drum tarp,
you can hear him tell lots of stories, including lots of story with his now former wife. You can also hear me tell him that I was attracted to him in a production of Assassins. So that was kind of a tough moment for me to have to grapple with live on the air.
We desperately tried to wrangle him back for another episode of drama, but, you know.
And he agreed.
He agreed, but the schedules just didn't work out with all the premieres and everything. But I'm going to wait till part two to say if he was, you know, the character is famously given the short end of the stick, no pun intended. And it's just one of those things, like, he doesn't even really sing that much. And so, yeah.
It didn't even dawn on me while watching it that they were together. For some reason, that just, like, escaped my mind. And obviously, it's on the no-ask question for the press tour because it hasn't been mentioned by anyone. That's interesting that they're both just avoiding it. In that album, it was, like, all about her falling in love with him, I guess.
Yeah, Eternal.
And it had to be when they got together too.
I do love that album. Yes. It was in my mind in the way that when I watch Mrs. Miniver and you see Greer Garson with the actor who plays her son and you know they got married afterwards, like, that's how I felt watching Ariana Grande and Ethan Slater on screen.
And it will be part of the lore of
all I could think
forever.
About.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so fair.
Oh man. They're still together, right? Because he's posted her on
they're together.
On Maine.
It's wild. So weird.
Well, that was an excellent listener question from listener Sophia.
Yes, I had to chime in there with my important, I've been waiting since Nick posted it for this moment. So I'm very happy I got to ask. Let's get into Oscar potential. So a lot of these are around Ariana Grande, some of our listener questions, and then we can just talk generally about what we think. But we have two about Ariana. Ariana couldn't get a song in for Don't Look Up. Would they really go for her in an acting category? Then we have another one. Every year, there's at least one actor that gets all the precursors and misses the Oscar. Is Grande the likeliest? So I think there's some doubt maybe around her potential for getting in. What do you guys think about her getting into supporting actress?
If you had told me a month ago that people were predicting her, I don't know that I would have laughed. But maybe I've just, like, drank the green elixir and I'm fully on board for her supporting actress nomination. I would love to see her get nominated. I just don't know. Like, look at, like, a J-Lo and Hustlers. Gaga, you know, Beyond a Star is Born for acting. Do they take pop stars seriously? Cher certainly was taken seriously at a point. What do you think, Dylan?
I think she's 100% getting in.
I think if the movie does as well as people think it is, she'll be included.
And I think she's going to carry a lot of nominations with her. I think Cynthia will be in conversation because of her. And the movie itself, I think, is a Best Picture contender. So a lot of the design, or you all would call them the below the line category, right?
Yes,
I remember when you guys were explaining it one time and I was like, I never knew that. So I think yes, especially if Selena and Zoe Saldana, you know, it's a musical stacked category. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
It is. I don't love the Don't Look Up comparison. I also think that's a little different because that's a song branch and this is the acting branch, which is a lot bigger. I also don't think it should be framed around her. It's like Cynthia Erivo is the Oscar nominee already. I think it's this year going to be a harder category to compete in for her to be in lead, and Ariana might be a little bit more open right now in supporting actress. So I think that's it for me. Leading up to the Oscars, I could see Cynthia Erivo getting into lead actor as a Golden Globe nominee in comedy or musical, and maybe that helping her along the way stay in the conversation. With that, I would say fifth spot in actress being maybe a little bit more in the air.
Well, I think the interesting thing, I actually think Cynthia Erivo is the case of an actor who gets all the precursors and misses Oscar just because of how competitive Best Actress is. you know, with Golden Globes, you have 6 nominations in both lead categories. She's definitely getting in for actress in a comedy musical. If she doesn't, what are we doing here? Yeah. It's a great performance, and we have so many spots. Critics' Choice, I can see her getting in there. SAG, I would be shocked if SAG doesn't go for her in this performance. And then BAFTA, I mean, BAFTA is always weird, but she's British.
Yeah.
So there you go. You have those precursors that could absolutely happen. But then at Oscar, I could see something like Fernanda Torres for I'm Still Here getting in. You know, someone who maybe doesn't hit precursors, but who is giving a fantastic performance that maybe critics back up, but we don't see in the industry until later on down the road. As far as Ariana Grande goes, though, I think she's really strong in supporting actress. Let me be clear. I think this is a lead performance. I think they should both be in lead.
Yeah.
I think this is category fraud, as are many people running in supporting actress right now. Zoe Saldana, category fraud. Danielle Deadwyler, you could argue, is category fraud for The Piano Lesson. Those are big cases. And then, of course, I mean, not the movie. Kieran Culkin is a straight-up lead, and he's running and supporting actor.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So it's just category fraud city right now with campaigning, which it is every year. But I do think she's getting in. But I think the film's strength really is in the crafts, like production design, costume design, makeup and hairstyling. I think we'll see nominations there. I don't love the visual effects, but I could see a nomination for it there. I think there's a lot of potential, yes, as we say, below the line.
Below the line. Question that might not be relevant to the conversation, but who is Emilia Perez running for lead?
Carla Sofia Gascon. So the titular Emilia Perez.
Got it.
Oh.
And then Selena Gomez and Zoe Saldana are both in supporting.
Yeah. I guess it would be weird if they put the titular role.
Well, they did for Judas and the Black Messiah, though.
They sure did.
Yeah.
But I think Zoe and Carla are co-leads.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I would say Selena supporting.
Yeah, it's fair.
For sure.
Selena supporting.
Selena,
you know,
yes.
The conversation we always have with movie musicals is looking at the Tonys. So, you know, looking back at what Wicked won and was nominated for, it won 3 Tonys for actress for Idina Menzel. Kristen was also nominated in lead. So they were co-leads, which I agree with there. Idina won. Kristen was very happy for her and was thanked by Idina in her speech. They won for scenic design, which could translate to production design, and then also costume design, which I think it could as well. It was also nominated for Best Musical, which lost to Avenue Q. I'm curious what you guys think about that, but that could be Best Picture, the score, book of a musical, choreography, orchestrations, and lighting design. I don't think cinematography shows up, but I think if we're looking at sound as that musical element, I think it could there. Maybe editing in a real long shot. I don't really think so, but it does have a potential across the board. And I think we were assuming maybe it would. And now I think it has solidified itself as a definite player in multiple categories.
For the people who think it's winning Best Picture, it needs an editing nomination. So you do have to see that come along with it.
Is that the key?
That's one of the keys.
Yeah, and the Tony's equivalent we've seen in recent years is you need the Best Book nomination to get.
I mean, there are some exceptions to the rule, like Coda. That didn't have editing, but that was its own beast.
Yeah.
But for a movie like this, we need to see editing.
I guess before we do our final question, would you guys have given it Best Musical over Avenue Q that year?
Oh my gosh. Well,
one of the most famous Best Musical showdowns in the modern era.
There's a full documentary about it. The Wicked vs. Avenue Q war at the Tonys. It is called Show Business, The Road to Broadway. And it is crazy. And it really talks about the controversy. It just proves that you don't necessarily need a Tony win to last, have a long cultural impact. Because Avenue Q, when it came out, it still is one of the most creative concepts, I think, ever on Broadway. It is so filthy and raunchy and irreverent and hilarious. And I don't know if I agree that it should have won over Wicked, but oh my God, it's such a deserving winner.
It was like this, the post 9/11 couple of Best Musical wins. Like, we had Hairspray in there, I think the next year as well. And their whole campaign was Vote With Your Heart. And they had like pictures of the puppets and different things like that. You know, they both were around for a really long time, but obviously I think Wicked won at the end of the day. So as far as the whole actress showdown, that is an After Dark episode. That's or maybe a drama plot.
Okay.
Yeah. Look on our Patreon because the Kristen versus Adina controversy that's now been squashed and put to bed, it was real and it did exist during that campaign. Not necessarily
at least in
them,
the public eye. Teams, yeah.
How they were pitted against each other. So pretty terrible, but juicy as hell.
To wrap up this episode, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
You know, we've seen this trend of best supporting actress going, you know, Jennifer Hudson, Ariana DeBose, Ariana Grande, I think, would be its best bet.
I agree. For everything I've already said in the whole episode, and I also want to mention Anne Hathaway in my notes.
Oh, of course. It came true.
Yes. I think she is I walked away from the movie being like, I am astonished. I'm so astonished by this performance. She gave me everything I wanted and more.
I'm going to say best actress for Cynthia Erivo. I think for everything that I've mentioned in this pod, I love her. She did everything for me that I needed Elphaba to do and want her to do. If this were a co-lead situation and we weren't looking at what the Oscars are putting her in, would you guys still pick Ariana over Cynthia for any actress category?
I wouldn't.
I don't think so.
I don't know, though. Ariana is kind of the revelation of the movie to me. And I think that Cynthia will get the nom for part two. For the win.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, as I'm thinking about it, Ariana was in almost every single scene. They put Glinda in scenes in this movie that she's not in the stage show. The camera just loved her. They cut to her for every single reaction shot. I mean, they're co-leads. And I think I would pick Ariana.
Well, you guys just led me in perfectly to my answer because I was going to say my Oscar for Wicked Part One will go to Ariana Grande. She, for me, was the highlight of the movie and the performance. I mean, I love them both, but I am just thinking about her humor a little bit more. And that's part of the character design, I think, too. But she is the one I come away from the movie thinking about and the performance I'm thinking about. But I'll give it to Cynthia for sure when we do part two. I think that just will absolutely happen based on what I know about that role in the second part.
So we'll see you next year.
See you next
literally
year.
Literally next Thanksgiving.
Same time next year.
We're reconvening.
The burn on me. Is that our 2025 drama while?
I think so.
Oh my God.
You guys have to come back on our show in the meanwhile. Yeah. Between it will be that. We'll be
oh
that.
My God.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on again. This is our favorite episode every year. It's so much fun to have you here. And for talking about this movie, I think, in particular.
Oh, thank you. It's truly an honor to come on your show where you have literal like qualified guests all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you were just so smart and have such an eye for it and your tastes. I listen to every single episode of your podcast every week and it exposes me to new things about film and makes me love it in new ways. So thank you for having us.
Yeah, I feel like as kids, we would read Entertainment Weekly to get our movie, what we need to watch. And now we just listen to Oscar Wilde to get out our movies.
Oh my gosh.
That's a compliment.
I couldn't be happier to be on the show this year as we love you both so much. And it's could do this for another hour.
We usually do.
We really could. I mean, thank you guys so much. You guys come here for movies and we come to you for Broadway. And I love hearing all of your insights as well. And you guys talk to so many people in the industry. So that's also so accomplished. So you guys deserve all of that back to you.
I got thank you. Yeah.
And tell everyone where they can find you and Drama.
We are at The Drama Podcast on all social media, including Blue Sky, not the Western skies, Blue Sky. And at Dylan McDowell is where I can be found. And Connor is at Connor McDowell. Our podcast is everywhere, especially on iHeartRadio, which is where we would love you to listen to us in particular.
We've done tons of Wicked episodes, tons and tons and tons. We've had original cast members, current cast members from the film, including Ethan Slater and Kiel Settle. So definitely check us out.
Well, congratulations again on the iHeartRadio partnership.
Thank you.
We'll definitely be listening there. And thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And for bonus content, you can go to patreon.com/Oscar Wilde. And you can also find our updated Oscar predictions on our website, oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.